I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House has announced a new plan regarding contraceptives and religious institutions. Now, to refresh, the White House recently announced a requirement that religious universities, hospitals, and charities have insurance plans that provide free birth control to employees who request it, as other employers do. Then, even though many Catholic universities already have plans that provide contraceptives, and even though polls show 98% of Catholic women use contraception at some point, Republican presidential candidates and some religious groups seized on the rule as an attack on religious freedom. Republicans in the House were proposing a law stripping all contraception requirements from insurance plans. Laura Meckler is White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Laura, what's the change?
Well, it's a very subtle change. Basically, for everybody who's at a secular employer, this coverage will just be included as part of their health insurance package. But if you're working for a big hospital or charity that's affiliated with a religious organization, the way it'll work is that employer will have the option to opt out of the requirement. If they opt out of the requirement, then the insurer will be required to provide, as a sort of separate package, health contraceptive coverage, and they will be required to provide it for free.
So in other words, a Catholic hospital, let's say, doesn't have to have free coverage of contraception in their plan, the one they give to employees, but they can refer that employee back to the insurance company, and then outside of the hospital's business, the insurance company will provide the employee with the free contraceptives?
Right. And they don't even have to refer them to it. It just has to be a relationship or something established between the insurance company and the employee.
Well, the White House is getting some positive support from both sides of this debate. The president of the Catholic Health Association, which represents Catholic hospitals, say they're pleased with the revised rule. Planned Parenthood say they back the changes. The administration still committed to making sure all women have access to birth control. But, you know, we've been hearing from Catholic leaders. There's a Bishop William Laurie who says the church must have the freedom to refuse to cooperate in any way in making contraceptives available. This would seem as if it's a church that is at least cooperating in setting up a second stream of contraceptives to employees.
The way the White House is explaining it is that really the religious organization won't have anything to do with it. And we should keep in mind that churches and houses of worship, those that where the employees are predominantly of the same faith, they're exempted altogether.
Right.
But this is for, say, Catholic charities or a university, again, a bit large hospital. Those organizations, the idea behind this, whether it'll be workable in practice, I don't know, but the idea behind this is that they can just on their own, employees can get that coverage directly from the insurance company. We haven't yet heard from the U.S. Conference of Bishops, and they've been the most critical of this. So we'll be looking to see what they have to say.
Well, meanwhile, tell us a little bit about the reasoning here. Polls were showing that the president had a lot of support for this requirement that institutions, again, not houses of worship, but institutions like hospitals, provide contraceptives for their employees. And again, another caveat, doctors in those hospitals, for instance, do not have to provide contraceptives to patients. We're just talking about employee coverage. 73% of Democrats agreed with the thinking, 62% of women, even 58% of Catholics agreed. But there was, and there has been, a huge uproar on the Republican presidential campaign. Why was this, you know, what was the thinking behind the change?
Well, it was to try to quell this incredibly, you know, divisive and distracting firestorm that had happened around this decision. I mean, this was something that the White House was being asked multiple questions about every single day. This is, you know, priests were talking about this during masses on Sunday. And a lot of people were, even people who use birth control or who don't think there's anything wrong with using birth control, were saying, this is wrong. It's wrong to make somebody do something that's against their conscience. So there was a lot of people who disagreed with it. Of course, there were just as many people or maybe more on the other side who said, you know, this is an important service. All women should have access to it. So they've really trying to, like, walk a very fine line on this. It had become enormously distracting for the White House. I should say the White House had, you know, says that they were always planning on revising this. They were going to, you know, they had a year to work on it, and this was their plan all along. But it's obvious that they were not expecting the kind of uproar that they got.
Laura Meckler, you've mentioned that, you know, we're still waiting to hear from some important voices. But do you think this really takes the energy out of this issue?
It will take some of the energy out of this issue, I think. Whether it ends or not, we'll see. But that's certainly what the White House is hoping for, an end to this, no doubt about that. I do think that it will tamp down a bit. We'll have to see what the reaction is of the people who were the most offended by it. We've already heard from some, but we haven't heard from all yet.
Laura Meckler, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Let's turn to our Friday conversation, which is usually a little bit off the well-trod news track. According to a recent study, the number of women participating in college sports is at a record high. Researchers at Brooklyn College say nearly 200,000 women will play on college teams this year, the 40th anniversary of Title IX, that federal legislation designed to prevent gender discrimination in college sports. And that's a long way from a five-year-old asking her dad over 20 years ago, "Why do only boys play sports?" That girl was Ella Strauss. Her dad was sports writer Robert Strauss. They were watching a Philadelphia 76ers basketball game. And Dad writes he remembers babbling something like, "Well, no, girls play sports," while thinking, "Don't they? They must, right?" Robert grew up in the 60s, a sports guy who maybe didn't play all that great, but memorized stats, was the idiot savant of baseball trivia. He dreamed of the son he'd named Sam after his father. There would be pickup games, bonding, just like in that song from Carousel, the man who sings about his boy Bill, until...
Wait a minute. Could it be? What the hell? What if he is a girl?
That's right. Robert had girls.
A girl?
Two of them, Sylvia and Ella, the one who asked, "How come only boys play sports?" Robert tells of the sports journey they all took together in his book, Daddy's Little Goalie. And Robert Strauss joins us from WHYY in Philadelphia. Robert, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Robert Strauss, I had to say it, but like many men, when Ella asked you this, you really didn't know about girl sports.
No, I didn't. I have to admit that when I was in high school, girls played six-girl basketball. They wore skirts. Six-girl basketball because only two could play offense and two could play defense because presumably they didn't have enough energy to get down the court.
That's right. Or in volleyball, you could be the roving player, because they
That's
had
right.
one person go in and out just to so nobody would take the vapors.
But suddenly Ella was asking me this question, and we went to a girls' basketball game the next day. It started us on that road.
Because she loved it. This is Haddonfield High in New Jersey playing Haddon Heights. She starts this little thing, and she's suddenly screaming and yelling, and we're winning because it was a drubbing. Haddonfield High, historically terrific sports school. And you realized you had your first lesson to teach her.
I drag her out. The game's like 58-14 or something like this. And she's saying, "Well, why can't we stay? We're winning." I said, "Sometimes when you win by too much, you really don't win at all." So in one day, I already had a sports lesson for her.
Well, so it began. This is about 20 years ago. You start getting sucked into a youth sports industry, also fantasy. You say you start driving by a fencing studio. Maybe I get her an épée.
And then I would start being maniacal. You go to T-ball. I taught them how to hit left-handed because, one, you're closer to first base. Two, all the crummy girls are on second base and can't catch the ball. So then Ella got a monumental amount of ground ball home runs. And third, the coaches think, "Oh, a left-hander. I could do something with that kid."
And this kid, we have to say, is six. So
<Yeah. laughs>
you start getting into this and thinking, it's like that trap you write about. Maybe your girls could be the one.
I always tell the line that if I had a boy, the little bubble would go up above your head and he'd be pitching against, Roy Halladay in the World Series. But girls, you could just be that best girl, I suppose. But then the revelation did come over me because of, I worked for Sports Illustrated. I worked at other big papers, whether it's sports or not. And I realized, that's a little insane. And I decided to be a sort of different kind of sports parent. And that was the one who was always there, but shut up.
Well, you didn't want to coach them. Why didn't you want to coach them, by the way?
I couldn't reprimand another kid that wasn't mine. And I couldn't keep playing time straight. And I knew if I didn't, that would be the end of me in the community, I think.
There's one moment as Ella starts making her way through some of the teams and you see her score a basket. In fact, she's the high scorer with like 3 points. But you're so excited about it. And then you are on the periphery when her coach is talking to her afterwards and he says something like, "Ella, you need to share the ball." And you realize,
right.
Oh, yeah, I would never have thought of that.
Well, my wife calls me the pussycat dad in relation to the Tiger Mom, because there was a team that Sylvia was on. She was a goalie. It was a team that scored one goal the whole year. So I would come home from games elated that it was only 2-0. I would be just the rosiest colored glasses and the not only the half-filled glasses, but the ones overflowing, you know.
Well, which is lovely to read. You know, this idea that you just love seeing your girls out there. And ultimately, they play soccer. They play basketball. Sylvia tries diving. Ella tries rowing. I mean, it's amazing, the sports ground that they're covering. And you are also, it's being revealed to you, this sports hierarchy that, you know, already applies to little boys. Now it's applying to girls. Can you describe some of this, you know, the A, the B?
The A and B team is just sort of amazing. I recount an episode where Sylvia is trying out for this soccer team, and one of the Philadelphia Flyers lives in our town, Eric Weinrich. I could see his nervousness. You know, this is a guy who's been in the Stanley Cup, and his daughter, his 9-year-old daughter, is trying out for a soccer team. And will she make the A team? But I always use this line, is that Scottie Pippen, one of the greatest players in NBA history, he was always on Michael Jordan's team. And so to Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen was the B team. Mm-hmm. So at some point, somebody's going to be better than you. And you just have to sort of face it, I suppose.
But as you write, it's like Sylvia felt she was forced to go to the dark side of the world of spring soccer and all it portended, most prominently the dreaded tryout system and the separation, almost gulag-like, with apologies to real gulags, of the A from the B. You even had somebody come to your knock on your door to recruit Ella to be on a B team?
Ella decided that soccer wasn't really for her. She played it, you know, as a little kid. But then one day our neighbor came to the door because the B team was short a kid. And he came almost like the Grim Reaper. And I can't remember how many pages of papers I had to sign just to get her on this B team that just absolutely needed a kid to have 11.
But she does get on the B team, and I'm wondering, how do the girls feel about this? I mean, parents have their own sense of, well, gee, you know, that doesn't seem fair, separating the very best from the next to best. If it's not as if we're going to the Olympics here, maybe, you know, if it was mixed up more, it could rise all boats. But did the kids care? I mean, how at this point are your girls liking sports?
The big change, if I may say, about girls' sports came when kids stopped playing Sandlot, whatever it was. But then, I don't know, 5 years old, when my kids were at that age, the clarion call goes out for T-ball, soccer, and basketball, I suppose, for everybody. And everybody comes out. So at that point, everybody wants to be where Christine is on Tuesday night. You know, that's basically it. They want to be with their friends. So I think they enjoyed it to that extent. It wasn't until 5th, 6th, 7th grade, I think, that they cared about this being better or worse. Sometimes it devastated kids. Sometimes it didn't.
Robert Strauss, author of Daddy's Little Goalie, A Father, His Daughters, and Sports. Dad is a sports reporter who 20 years ago wondered if he could even bond with girls over sports. But his daughters, Ella and Sylvia, grow up and play sports in high-achieving Haddonfield, New Jersey, in a post-Title IX world. Sports start out as a way for them to socialize, but then get more serious, more expensive. He gets more involved. And Robert, the girls graduate to traveling teams. You're driving them hundreds of miles, paying for hotels, wondering, why aren't we playing the town next door? You're paying $500-$600 for uniforms and equipment for just one sport. The girls are going to summer sports camps at nearby colleges. Then you discover secret tennis and super secret tennis. What is that?
Haddonfield's tennis coach, Jeff Holman, is the winningest tennis coach in the history of the United States.
Sounds amazing.
He schedules matches every day, which is, of course, why he's the winningest. But the point here is that somehow Sylvia found out, or we found out, about the Friday nights that he would have the junior high kids for free at some indoor tennis thing in the winter. So she gets to get on secret tennis. And then super secret tennis was, if you were good enough, you got to play Saturday nights.
And you're not being critical of this. This was these coaches donating their time.
Exactly. And, you know, we live in a Garrison Keillor-like town where not only is everybody above average, everybody is above average, you know. And I always think that the sign coming into Haddonfield should say Haddonfield, land of extra credit. The last 2 years, they've won 7 state championships in sports. But, you know, in this land of overachievers, there are overachievers, too. And my kids were not overachievers. They were not the best kids. My daughter goes to Davidson now, and she's decided she's going to play IM basketball again. She's 5 foot tall.
So intramural, intramural.
And so in the backyard over break, she had me rebound for her as she made her three-pointers and all this other stuff. And I felt like it was back palling around with her again at 20 now, as it was when she was 6. So that it gave us a place to go.
Well, but this is after another moment. You describe one day racing from one location where Ella's playing to another where Sylvia's playing. You walk in to see each of them sink a three-pointer. What a joy. But then you realize afterwards that was their last three-pointer because they quit. And you find out that when Ella is doing some of her college essays, as you write, you weren't exactly the villain in the reason that she quit, but how did you say it? You might have been a little overbearing.
The upside of being with your kids all the time is that you're with your kids all the time. The downside is that sometimes it is a little bit too much. And you don't realize it. And both of them decided to stop playing basketball after that day. So it is sort of a tragic irony, I suppose. Well, maybe not so tragic, but an irony that they felt that, at least in this one sport, I was too much.
Well, and then in another essay that I guess a friend has to write for you, a peer has to write an essay for you in one of her college applications, and he wrote about how she was worried about that. She didn't want to hurt you or jeopardize your bond.
That's true. And her friend Mike wrote this, that there was a conflict there, that she did enjoy being with me, but basketball was over.
And she worried about how you'd feel about that. Well, you know, now Robert Strauss, you were on the other side of this whole story when you first started. Someone who had always thought you'd have a son and wasn't sure what a relationship between a father and a daughter with sports could be like. Now you're on the other side of it. What was it like during it? What was it like to sit and watch, and often with your wife Sue, to sit and watch them play?
I always say this. I still play basketball. I'm one of the better 60-year-olds, but I play with a lot younger guys at this gym in Philly, and I was there, and one of the guys, he has young kids, and he says to me, "Well, Strauss, what's it like watching your kid play sports?" And I said, "Monroe, here's the story." I said, "There's other 9 kids out there. They're in black and white. Your kid's in Technicolor." And that's really the way I feel.
They never were the one. They weren't the best. They were amazing. I can't believe how many sports they played.
Right.
But they were never the one.
Correct. I mean, you know, they were pretty good at what they were doing. But you sit there and you realize that this was just a way to be with them. That if they were in the school play, it would have been just fine. Except that if your kid is an actor, you're lucky if there's 3 plays and 3 performances a year. But there are a bazillion games to go to. That's not even 1/3 of a lacrosse season.
I forgot about lacrosse. They also played lacrosse. What do you think they got from it? Ella at least decided, you know, I'm going to play intramural. I'm going to have fun. I don't want to do, you know, push myself for the competitive anymore. What is Sylvia playing now in high school?
Sylvia, though she quit basketball, she replaced it with indoor track and managing the wrestling team. She plays lacrosse at a pretty high level because she's in one of these summer fancy teams, and she plays tennis on this continual state championship team. So I think, well, for one thing, they're fit. And for another thing, they got to be with kids being somewhat outstanding. They're very good students, and I always say, take the hardest class, not because you're going to be most successful in it, but because you're going to be with the best kids. I mean, don't you want to do the science project with the best kid instead of some schlepper? They got to play on these teams instead of, I don't know, sitting home and watching Teen Mom too many times.
And what's so great in reading your book is that you realize, I don't think the father of a boy could have more fun and be more involved than you were. It just doesn't feel like there's any other level than the one that you had. But as you said, you know, you're kind of a fair basketball player. What do you say to people who say, oh, you know, you're kind of living vicariously through your girls?
I'd say it's true. I thought up this little slogan long ago, and my wife, it's the one thing that endears her to me in this whole sports thing, and that is, if you didn't want to live through your kids, then why did you have them?
That's Robert Strauss. His book is Daddy's Little Goalie, A Father, His Daughters, and Sports. You can see a picture of all of them at hereandnow.org, as well as read an excerpt from the book. Robert, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
The White House is warning that the budget cuts the president will unveil on Monday will be painful. We were wondering how they might affect the government agency whose sole job is to save the government money. The Government Accountability Office, or GAO, has been called the taxpayer's friend because of its investigations into fraud and waste. For example, the GAO found that the Interior Department failed to collect proper revenues from the sale of offshore oil and gas leases. And it was the GAO that found that airport screeners failed to meet current standards for detecting explosives in checked luggage. Now the GAO is being asked to tighten its belt. Ed O'Keefe writes the Federal Eye column for the Washington Post. Ed, you report that the GAO staff could drop below 3,000 for the first time in more than 75 years. Now, people might be thinking, 3,000? That sounds a lot, like a lot, and it's, you know, it would be down from 3,250. So that sounds bloated, but, you know, are people concerned about the cuts?
Well, it is of concern to people who track government oversight and to those of us who sort of rely on their ability to get information, because certainly if you have fewer people in the field tracking waste, fraud, and abuse and doing investigations on the health and the management of federal programs, then, yeah, you could conceivably have some issues. And the agency is warning that, you know, dropping to that level for the first time in more than 75 years means that certain things might slide.
And when you think of 50 states, suddenly 3,000 people doesn't sound, you know, like a lot. They have a lot of ground to cover. Let's just remind people, though, the GAO investigates at the request of Congress. Is the GAO considered their lapdog or their watchdog?
It's more their watchdog. Certainly there are groups who, you know, come out on the poor end of an investigation or an audit and then start to accuse it of, you know, perhaps being a lapdog, but generally over the course of its existence, it's had a very strong nonpartisan reputation for delivering pretty hard-hitting investigations that sort of help Congress sort out what's working and what isn't.
Well, conservative Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn says the agency's audits and investigations are critical. Just one supporter there. Staffers can go undercover, for instance. List some of those critical investigations they've done.
Well, one of the big ones last spring was an investigation that looked at government redundancy. They found, for example, that there were an estimated $58 billion spent on all sorts of sort of surface transportation programs, that there were others, multiple programs that dealt with education. And there was just sort of a question of, do we need all of these in different agencies doing essentially the same thing? And it prompted Republicans to begin looking at this and say perhaps we should find a way to trim back. And even the White House now over the summer launched a program to try to find these redundancies and find ways to merge and consolidate different programs. And they're pushing, at least in one case, to bring together a bunch of trade and commerce offices and agencies together under one roof to reduce some of the overhead and refocus them on the mission of creating jobs and pumping up the economy.
So if both sides of the aisle seem so happy with what the GAO is doing and how it is ultimately saving money, why are they cutting 250 personnel?
Because everyone on Capitol Hill and everyone across Washington is getting ready to cut the budget. They faced budget cuts this year. The Senate subcommittee responsible for handing out money to congressional offices and other congressional agencies said, look, along with everyone else in Washington, we've got to cut back. So, sorry, we understand that you do a lot of important work, but you, too, have to face a budget cut. Yeah. So GAO had to cancel, some technology upgrades. It had to get rid of some contractors, and it is cutting its staff considerably and to sort of historically low levels. Everyone in Washington is cutting back, and this agency is no exception.
Well, you talked about consolidation. There are other research-focused arms of Congress. There's the Congressional Research Service. It's called Congress's think tank. And the Congressional Budget Office. We're more familiar with them, maybe. They provide economic data to lawmakers. They're considered nonpartisan. Could the CBO and the CRS, the Research Service, and the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, all be combined?
Probably not, simply because they do have such different missions. GAO is sort of the private investigator for Congress. CRS is kind of the librarian or the historian, and the CBO is the accountant. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to bring them all under one roof when they're doing such different things.
Ed O'Keefe writes the Federal Eye column for The Washington Post, talking ahead of President Obama's budget speech on Monday, how the Government Accountability Office might lose some staffers in that belt tightening. Ed, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
The picture on the front page of the New York Times yesterday took our breath away. An Afghan woman, her head covered like Mary, in a dark hut looking down at her baby, a little bear on his fleece blanket. The child has frozen to death. Andrea Bruce took the picture for the Times. Rod Nordland has been reporting the story of the 24 children who've died from the cold in two refugee camps right in the shadow of the Afghan capital, Kabul. With $3.5 billion in humanitarian aid and $58 billion in development aid over 10 years, how can this be? We reached Rod in Kabul. Rod, why are these Afghans in refugee camps?
Most of them are war refugees from Helmand province and Kandahar province in southern Afghanistan.
Well, and why are the babies and toddlers freezing to death? I mean, you list them by name, twin girls who were 3 years old, the baby in the picture yesterday, Khan Mohammed, 3 months old. Why are they freezing to death?
Well, often you'll find four people or more sharing one or two blankets in temperatures that are in the mid-teens Fahrenheit. Many, many of the huts and tents that they're in have no heating sources at all. And many of them go out, for instance, and just gather scraps of paper and even plastic soda bottles and so on to burn, toxic as it is, and they have nothing else.
Well, and you've been doing some terrific reporting on this, and you had a meeting with some of the elders of the camp, of one camp, including fathers of the toddlers who have died, and they said that when you have many people sharing blankets, if the covers get pulled off the infants, they don't know how to get them back.
That's right. And they don't know how to ask for help, and they certainly can cry. But as one family told me, our kids cry every night because they're so cold. And after a while, the parents are so exhausted, they fall asleep, and the child becomes disentangled from the communal blanket and freezes to death.
Yeah. This is the worst winter people have seen in 20 years. And they admitted to you that many of them had gotten warm clothing and blankets from aid agencies months ago, but not knowing how cold it was going to be, they sold it.
Right. They sold it because they didn't have enough food, or they didn't have enough money to buy medicine, or for any number of other reasons, maybe even some frivolous reasons. And a lot of aid groups have become frustrated with them because they've repeatedly taken aid to them and then stuff gets sold off. But, you know, there's still the fact that these children are really vulnerable, and in way too many cases, they're dying.
And here you have government officials, one of them saying to you, I'm not saying they're lying, but I'm skeptical that these children are freezing to death. Why?
Well, I think they're embarrassed that this is happening right under their noses and nothing has been done about it. And, you know, they're in denial. So they explain it away, saying, oh, they must have just died of disease and this is just a coincidence. And how do we know they died of exposure to the cold? Because nobody gave them an autopsy and no doctor looked at them. Well, there's no doctor to look at them in most cases. And the families, you know, following Islamic tradition, want to get them buried as soon as possible. One official, the head of the disaster agency, even said, well, you know, it's very suspicious that they all died at night. Well, if that's not a moronic statement, I don't know what is. You know, of course, the temperatures are 20 degrees colder at night.
Well, the officials also told you that they were, you know, upset about what they see as this one-sided reporting of the deaths without reporting how much aid has been given to the residents. Government officials also tell you they offered some of these camp residents land to resettle on back in Helmand province where they came from, also gave them homes to live in this area, rental homes. But then the camp dwellers subletted the premises for income instead of living out of them. So what do people in the camp say to those accusations?
Well, about the rental housing, they say that's a lie. And I don't know the truth of it. There may be have been some cases where some rental homes were given to refugees and something like that happened. But I haven't seen any proof of that. And the government's credibility, I think, on this is fairly low. As for going to land plots in Helmand, that's true. The government has provided land plots for them in places like Goresh and Sangin district and other places that are crawling with Taliban and still in the middle of a very hot war. And these people do not want to go back.
What does this tell us, if anything? Is this a cautionary tale about Afghanistan itself, about Kabul, about the leadership there? I mean, what does it illustrate?
I don't think the Afghan government's the only one to blame. I mean, there is this huge international presence in Afghanistan, and why hasn't the international community done something more about it? Well, the short answer is that these people have become victims of a kind of bureaucratic catch-22, in which, because they've been in these camps for a long period of time, that's not considered a humanitarian crisis because it can't be an emergency if it goes on year after year. So they're not entitled to humanitarian aid. The other form of aid, what they call development aid, they're not entitled to that either because development aid is for building cities and schools. And also a lot of the humanitarian community has taken the lead of the government, in which the government says, well, this problem shouldn't be here because these people should go back to the land that we put aside for them in Helmand or Kandahar or whatever.
And the government says, and if you give them aid, then they will stay there and more people will come there.
Right. And, you know, there's probably some truth to that. But that just looks past the fact that there are these very vulnerable people, and these children especially, that need some kind of aid to get through this crisis.
How are these families handling this? We started with the family of Saeed Mohammed, again, losing his eighth child to the cold. He lost other children to illness. And his remaining daughter, Ferosa, you meet her. She's 10. She's standing there staring at her baby brother being swaddled for burial, and she's sick. She's coughing. How are they handling this?
You know, you look into the eyes of this father, and you feel like you're just looking at into the just black heart of despair. You know, it just seems completely without any kind of hope at all. And it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking.
Well, your writing about it has gotten a lot of response locally, and you've heard from Americans. Lieutenant General John Bradley, who is retired from the Air Force and started a charity, an American charity, who's diverting winter aid from his charity to people in the camps. But can it be changed?
Yes, enough aid can get into the camps to save these kids' lives. And sadly, you know, all these groups, including some of the ones that we've written about, none of them have managed to move quickly enough to get basics like firewood and food into the camps. They have their rules and their policies and their procedures, and they have to meet with their boards. And so far, the only aid that has gone into the camps in the last week has been from private individual businessmen. And these are Afghan businessmen. And I think that's kind of a sorry commentary. We have this massive aid effort, and they're not able to respond to an emergency of this degree.
Rod Nordland of the New York Times, along with photographer Andrea Bruce, he has been telling the story of two refugee camps in Kabul in which young children are freezing to death. Rod, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
I'm still not tired of it. And everyone from the metal band Linkin Park to Jimmy Fallon have covered it. Here's a mashup of fans on YouTube.
If you have my heart inside your hands, complaining to love me.
All hail Adele. She's nominated in 6 categories at this Sunday's Grammy Awards, including Record of the Year and Album of the Year. And what a year it's been. Her second CD, 21, was the best-selling album of 2011, and Sunday will be her first performance since vocal cord surgery. But we loved her first. Kidding, but I do remember going to see Adele at a concert and thinking, who are all these other people? She's talking to me. Maura Johnston is music critic at The Village Voice. She joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. And Maura, put your finger on the appeal.
I think she's just very relatable. I think that, you know, she writes about heartbreak and sorrow in these ways that are very cathartic and simply put. And of course, you know, she delivers them with this voice that's just this very powerful, beautiful instrument.
Should I give up or should I just keep chasing pavements even if it leads nowhere?
Well, then everyone knows about her heartbreaks, and so young. Mm-hmm. She's only 23 now. She's like this old soul who at 19, with her debut album 19, you know, talked about these heartbreaks. A guy who broke up with her, and then he got married, In this Saturday Night Live skit, office workers secretly meet to cry over the song about that.
You both needed a good cry, so you were listening to Adele, Someone Like You. Do you do it too? Everyone with a heart and an iTunes account does. So I know it, I get it, and I want in.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
Maura Johnston, the Boston Globe just recently did a whole piece just about this one song and how people cry over it.
It's so simply put, and I think that's the beauty of it, is it's this very plain, unadorned sentiment, you know, with her just sort of laying it all out there. And I really feel like that's something that people are looking for, a connection when they listen to music. People are looking for something that they can latch on to. And the nature of her voice and the nature of the lyrics just combine into this package that a lot of people, you know, they feel it, and they feel their emotions being tugged or their memories being tripped.
But I said fire to the rain. Watch it burn as I touch your face. When it burn, will I cry? Cause I heard it screaming out your name. Your name.
I mentioned seeing her in concert. It wasn't a big theater. It was the House of Blues here in Boston, which isn't big, you know, hundreds of people. But still, she sits on a stool and, you know, talks about her love, like, back and forth with the audience, very intimate, very open, very, almost chatty.
And, you know, that's funny because it also comes through, like, in her blogging and stuff. She's very sort of open about things and with interviewers as well. I mean, I think that the power of hearing just one voice, you know, have, especially now in the headphone era where music listening is so much more personal too, I think that she sort of can establish this connection very easily. And you don't even need to kind of see her on the stool. You can kind of picture her sitting on the stool when she's just singing in your ears if you're listening on earbuds.
When will I see you again? With no goodbye, not a single word was said. No final kiss to seal any scenes. I had no idea of the state we were in.
It really is far more of a 60s sort of cabaret, or, you know, the Oak Room in New York. Mm-hmm. Kind of concert, especially when you compare it to what we just saw Madonna do at the halftime show, or Beyonce, who's unbelievable dancing, or Lady Gaga. This is such a throwback.
And, you know, it's funny because I remember when she first came out, she was sort of lumped in among the sort of Amy Winehouse clones. And, you know, she's definitely, I think, brought her aesthetic into an even more, you're right, you know, sort of Dusty in Memphis kind of thing,
yeah,
where she is just doing this plain and simple, and obviously, like, you know, sometimes she'll play with an orchestra, but I do think that there's a place for it in the current pop landscape.
She ain't real, she ain't gonna be able to love you like I will, she is a stranger.
Had a problem with some of the ways she's being described and you would say marketed. Why is that?
It's not the way that she's marketed, it's the way people are reacting to her marketing, because I do think that, you know, while there is obviously the appeal of the one-to-one intimacy, but I also know that, you know, the fact that she is doing this sort of unadorned thing, it's something that has an inherent appeal to people. And so, of course, it wouldn't be surprising if people exploited that in some way.
Well, to really underscore this, I mean, the Brit Awards last February, you know, the papers wrote Adele was so close to tears at the end of her performance of Someone that she had to turn away from the cameras. And, mm-hmm. you know, you list some of the ways, you know, she's described as being authentic. She doesn't sing with auto-tune. She's influenced right. by the greats. She's not skinny and she doesn't care. But you say she's as much a part of the machine as some of the other performers are.
Well, I think I'm kind of an absolutist on that, because all these artists have publicists. They all have marketing plans. They all have, you know, ways that they are rolled out to the public. Being brought to emotion by the fact that you're singing a song isn't necessarily the only sign that you're for real.
Didn't I give it up? Tried my best. Gave you everything I had. Everything and no less. Didn't I do it right? To let you down. Maybe you got too used to having me around.
Once you start sort of prizing, like, who's really feeling it over another person, you're really looking into motivations that might not be there, and you might be reacting to extra musical factors that aren't necessarily present.
You might be falling for it. Falling for the market, right, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Well, I was stunned to find out that there are other people nominated for Grammys.
I know, right?
Kanye West actually tops the nominations with 7, then Adele, mm-hmm. Foo Fighters, Bruno Mars with 6, Lil Wayne, and Skrillex each up for 5 awards. But it feels as if, I mean, do you remember a Grammys where there's been this much focus on one artist?
Well, there was the Amy Winehouse Grammys a couple of years back, mm-hmm. you know, when she was sort of coming off her trip to rehab and she performed in London by satellite. And I remember seeing her crying when she won one of the awards.
Right.
I mean, the thing about Adele, too, is that she's just such a well-rounded success story this year because, she, you know, she's selling records in a time when nobody is at all. And obviously, there's also the anticipation for her coming back from this throat surgery, which, you know, I mean, that was sort of scary there. I mean, when you get surgery on your vocal cords and you're a singer. So I think there's also that anticipation of what's going to happen. Is she going to be any different in performing?
That's Maura Johnston, music critic for The Village Voice. Maura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Close enough to start a war. All that I